And speaking of sharing, you know that idea that creative genius is all about single-minded obsession? One person's unique calling or vision. Well, that's just one model of creativity. Another is the collaborative duo. Think Lennon and McCartney, Watson and Crick. Joshua Wolfschenk calls these powers of two, and he says it's time we recognize the explosive creative potential of partners. Steve Paulson wanted some details.
Joshua, you talk about creative pairs as forming what you call a single organism. Can you explain what you mean by that?
When two people meet, they might be excited by each other. There might be a kind of feeling of jolt. Ralph Abernathy and Martin Luther King, or Sergey Brin and Larry Page. And yet you still have two distinct individuals. Over time, when people begin to work together and they become associated with a common body of work, or they become wrapped up in each other, a we emerges. And that is an enormously interesting phenomenon because, of course, the individuals remain and there is a sense of distinct ego, but that also begins to break down as you become part of this larger thing. And the science of relationships has shown us that at a very basic cognitive level, we begin to lose the distinctions between ourselves and other people, so that the we is not just a figure of speech and a way of talking. It also becomes a part of the way we think. There is even a phenomenon of a shared mind.
Well, it's interesting that you used the example of Ralph Abernathy and Martin Luther King, because Dr. King, of course, is seen as the great leader of the civil rights movement. He's not generally paired with Ralph Abernathy. I mean, of course, historians of the civil rights movement know of him, but they would see him as a secondary figure.
That's right. And it's very common that one person in these partnerships is out front, and one person may be the decided leader. That was certainly the case with Martin Luther King. They were a partnership, and they were not entirely equal. And Martin Luther King was also the spokesman and the philosopher king of that movement. It's very appropriate to understand his distinct role and what he did that was different from Abernathy. But it's very hard to understand what they created without looking at the they, without looking at the two of them together. And that happens over and over again. When you begin to understand relationships, you have to rewrite the Western canon.
So play that out for me a little bit. I mean, how did the coming together of Abernathy and King create some kind of new dynamism?
Martin Luther King was an abstract man. He was an intellectual man. He thought in these big ways. He had a soaring intellect. Abernathy was much more of a tactician. He had a very earthy sense of humor. He was the one who could really get the crowd riled up and could really connect with them in a really basic way. And he would set the stage for King to come and, you know, give this overview and speak not just to that particular audience. He was really speaking to the nation and to the world about the philosophy of nonviolence, which, you know, is not necessarily the thing that is going to get the crowded black church sort of roused up and ready for the particular action of that day. But it's also true that a lot of what happened between King and Abernathy is hard to trace. They were on the road together. They shared hotel rooms and motel rooms together. In fact, when Martin Luther King was assassinated, he was in a suite at the Lorraine Motel that they called the King-Abernathy Suite because they shared it so often together. And we don't know precisely what they said. And after King was gone, Abernathy was the only firsthand witness, of course, and people don't necessarily trust everything he said. Maybe his ego was involved. So it's hard to get at a lot of these relationships because so much is unrecorded.
Now, you write about a lot of creative pairs, and one of the most interesting ones was the partnership between C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. Of course, went on to write famous books in their own rights, but how would you describe their creative partnership?
It was a partnership between two distinct men who each authored his own independent body of work, and yet, in a way, they co-created this form of the mythic parable soaked in Christian imagery, and they did it through relentless conversation. They met each other. They were academics in a kind of stuffy environment. A lot of their colleagues would have thought them entirely foolish for thinking about the stories that they thought about made-up languages and talking lions and all that sort of thing. And yet they got each other. They loved the work that each man was doing, and they gave each other permission and were an audience and were an ever-present critic and responder and resonator for what the other did, you could really say in the big picture that they co-created each other as authors, even though they are not co-authors in the ordinary sense.
Well, you give the example going back to particularly this creative partnership between C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien of the critique that Lewis made of Tolkien's poem, The Lay of Lethian. Am I saying that right?
I believe so.
What did Lewis say about this poem?
One detail that's critical is that Tolkien had this poem on his desk for 4 years. He had not shared it with anyone until he shared it with Lewis, which is itself really significant that he was emboldened and had the courage to share it with Lewis because of the shared sense. And Lewis immediately wrote back praising it and saying that he would give him more detailed criticism. And then when he gave him the criticism, he did it in this very clever and playful way. He created a fictional panel of scholars, and he named them Pumpernickel, Peabody, Schick, Bentley, and Schuffer. He wrote the responses in these voices as though a formal presentation had been made to an academic panel, and, you know, five men were sitting in their wooden chairs in front of a oak-paneled room, intoning their distinct reactions to this work. And that allowed him to go into a great deal of detail and give this very idiosyncratic character to the critique. And the funny thing is that it was a critique to a piece of creative writing, but it was itself its own piece of creative writing.
Now, that's fascinating. Now, one of the most interesting stories you write about is about the poet Emily Dickinson. And she would seem to be the poster child of the lone genius, you know, off in her room creating these incredible poems. But you say that's a mistake to see her that way.
This is an important story for me because I'm a writer and I need an enormous amount of solitude. And my creative relationship with my book editor is very much in the rhythm of solitude and connection alternating with each other in a variety of ways. And I was dumbfounded to learn about Emily Dickinson and to see my idea of her, an idea that many people shared, that she was tremendously isolated and disconnected from the world around her in order to make these beautiful poems alone in her room, is really not the full picture. It is true that she withdrew from the world around her, that she didn't leave her father's home, that she didn't obey these social niceties, but she was doing that not to be disengaged, but because she needed a lot of space in her mind and around her in order to think and to gestate these letters and these poems, which she sent out like missives to the world. And she not only did that to connect with people in an abstract way, she was continually reaching out and choosing people to be her correspondents, to be her mentors, to be her editors in a way, and sending hundreds of poems to these people and thousands of letters. And if you look at the material of her work, it's electric with emotion and interpersonal passion. And this was something that she was deeply consumed by. So it's a story of her, and we need to revise our understanding of Dickinson, but it's also a broader story of people who need solitude, not because they're disinterested in the human world around them, but because from a place of solitude, they can connect better. And from a place of solitude, they can do the things that they do best. Steve Wozniak is another example in a totally different field in a different era, but he needed a lot of space around him to tinker with his gadgets and to work out these engineering problems. But it really became magic when he was able to bring that to someone like Steve Jobs, who knew how to shape it and knew how to market it and knew how to send him back into his cave with a particular assignment. And that movement is really critical to understand and really personal to me because it's so much part of my life as a writer.
Yeah. Well, to go back to the example of Emily Dickinson, I can imagine this might have worked in two ways. So if she's writing a poem and she sends it to someone else, that other person might write back with comments about it, maybe even criticisms, or the other person might just be kind of the audience that she needs. In other words, she sort of has that person in mind as she's writing the poem.
I think that's a very incisive observation. And sometimes what we need from someone is a certain kind of presence, is a certain kind of receptive attitude, and that stirs us up and brings something out of us, and we're not necessarily looking for any particular response. I know that's the case in my life, too, that I write differently, I speak differently, I feel like I am a different person in relationship to other people. And sometimes it's not any kind of discrete thing they say or do. It's the feeling that it generates in me. And that's something really at the bottom of this whole inquiry for me. I'm just fascinated by that feeling of chemistry and all the places it can lead. What's fascinating, though, is that when you really begin to appreciate how much of creativity is dialogical, how much of it is shaped in literal or metaphorical conversation between people, and you then take that model and look at how the creative mind works when we're walking on a beach or we're in front of a computer writing by ourselves, what happens in our mind is also a dialogical phenomenon. When you listen to creative people from Paul Simon to the great poet Ruth Stone, when you listen to creative people describe these aha moments, these moments of insight in Genesis, it's an experience of two forces, two places in their mind, or sometimes it seems like it's something from outside of your mind that's sort of transmitting to you. It's very hard to describe, and that's the reason why this old idea, this old myth of the muse is actually helpful, whether you believe in it as a true phenomenon or not. It's useful as a model for how the creative mind works.
Joshua Wolf-Schenk is the author of Powers of Two, Finding the Essence of Innovation in Creative Pairs. Steve Paulson talked with him.